for.
You've been writing something, and you just don't see how you can go along with this particular direction, or there isn't anything here that seems to make it. Your analysis just doesn't seem to add up, and you go leave it alone and do whatever other things you have to do, and all of a sudden, maybe in a day, maybe in 2 or 3 or 4 days later, you suddenly have an answer as to how you can handle that. And working with other faculty members can sometimes help. I have not worked as closely in my research and writing with colleagues as some people do. In some respects, I'm doing more of it right at this point in time than I've done almost any other time in my life. Partly, I think it's because I have been interested in something that much of what I've been interested in has had to deal with tax administration in some sort or other.
Yeah, just
Well, when I'm saying that about tax administration, I mean it in this sense. Many of my colleagues had very little interest in the field, and I had done some work with economists on it, with Harold Groves here, with Walter Heller at Minnesota, and at times in subsequent years, I've consulted with Bob Lampman. But his interest.
This is the beginning of tape five.
In the earlier years when I was here in the department, as I started to say, my interests were very substantially in the field of tax administration and in a general sense in tax policy. And there were not too many people in the department, and almost no one, who had these interests. Consequently, partly because of my own personality, I suppose, and partly because of this topic, I tended to do most of my work alone and only consulted occasionally with others, probably more with Bill Young than with anybody else, occasionally with Jim McCamey, and in the years when Herb Jacob and Ira Sherkansky were here, occasionally with them. We have suddenly gotten several young people that have somewhat overlapping and certainly complementary interests, and I'm finding it a real joy to work with John Whitty and Bruce Wallen, who especially share some of these interests. And while we're not doing anything collaboratively, it's fun to be able to share our interests, and we both have strengths and weaknesses in what we are able to do. I am not a statistician, and hence much of the work that one would do on a computer or in highly sophisticated statistical matters are more or less beyond my ken. With the result that when I get into some areas of this kind that I need some assistance on, and yesterday was one of those days, I've got a very good project assistant who's working on it, and then John Whitty spent an hour with us, and he and I share enough background that I can be sure that what he is giving in technical information still produces the kind of data and the kind of analysis that I want. And this is a very satisfying sort of
I should
thing to
think so.
do. And it's nice in these last few years that I'll be here that I have people to work with of that kind.
That's one of the big problems with a field that is, of which one's the only representative, that there isn't anybody to talk to.
Yes, now the other people had some kind of sense of it, but my detailed institutional sense of tax administration. Well, I remember, in fact, talking to Oliver Oldman from Harvard back in the 50s, and he and I agreeing that we didn't think there were a half a dozen people in the country that shared our particular kind of focus. That was an attempt to marry something of economic theory and the law and political policy in the tax field and administration, so that we were really encompassing at least four different directions in our attempt to develop what we were working on. And Oliver Oldman has continued to do a good bit of work. He's actually in the law school at Harvard, but he works pretty much in the same general direction and focus that I have had. And he's been helpful to me on occasion over the years because we do share that interest.
And your project assistant uses the computer.
The project assistant I have now, who is just getting his degree from economics here, and who was apparently their number one student this year because he got the Ely Award, does know computers, does know statistics beyond my knowledge of statistics, and altogether is working out extremely well, besides being a very nice person.
How'd you get him?
Well, he's a student here in the center. His name is Dan Speckard, S-P-E-C-A-R-D, and he's a student in the center here. So I'm paying him, and that's helping him. And I certainly intend to give him some credit when I get this written up, because he's been very helpful in the way he's operated.
You're talking about collegiality in a way, and this is something that Jim Scott spoke about, and or maybe I said that earlier. Did I? How much being having a family that you had to go and take care of interfered with it? He felt quite, while his wife was working on her degree. The subject of collegiality in the department, do you feel that it was once good and has changed, or is getting better, or?
I think that collegiality depends on everybody, of course, everybody that's involved. I think there is a sense in which collegiality was stronger when the department was smaller, but it would also be true that when the department was smaller, there were fewer real distinct differences in research interests. There were differences in emphasis, but we didn't have quite as varied a faculty in research interests. And so for each individual, both the individual's personality, the size of the department, and the people who may share particular interests and that you feel comfortable working with, and I think this has differed over the years. It is probably different for individual people. Mm-hmm. But in a very broad, general sense, I think there was probably somewhat more of it when there was a small department. But we have certainly found, in the recent years, because of some of the young people we've hired, especially with interest in the center, that there's been a very nice relationship, an easy inquiry of what they know about such and such, or what I know, or they're asking me what I know about such and such, and nobody worrying that that's going to put you down because you don't know some particular thing, just feeling very comfortable about asking questions and exchanging information. And so I would say that as far as I'm concerned, it's gone a little bit in cycles, and this is sort of ending with a very good cycle.
This is a continuation of the interview with Clara Penniman. This is July 27th, and we're going to be talking about the University Committee from 1971-2 to 1973-4. And you will begin by talk about the central administration issues. All right. You don't need this. We're not using it. It's inactive.
A merger coming on, and by the time we're discussing this, merger has been in place. There were a great many issues over how new administrators should be appointed. The Madison campus, and in fact the UW system, had pretty much taken on the Madison campus methods. The Madison campus had had a long tradition of faculty committees and search and screen committees with possibly, or with one or two administrators, depending upon the level at which the appointment was to be made, responsible for producing a list of candidates from whom the appointing, or from which rather, the appointing officers would make their selection. The old WSU system had not had a standard practice of using search and screen committees in the same fashion. And the administration under President Weaver fumbled at first in terms of developing adequate guidelines, at least from the point of view of Madison, in making these appointments. Further, there were problems of the meshing of the administrations between the old WSU system and the UW system. And there were one or two very major crises in which appointments were made by the administration. And I recall specifically the appointment of Don Percy as the vice president for finance that did not clear any faculty committee. And there were a good many questions raised over the procedure. And while nothing was redone in terms of those particular appointments, including the Percy appointment, there was a procedure developed then for the system as a whole and for system officials as well as for individual university officials that included faculty input. And it was over these years that this development took place until today the selection of system officials, that is, officials that are going to be related in an important sense to faculty concerns, do come through a list that is achieved by a faculty administrative committee. Hmm. And this is the major thing, but there was a lot of friction in those earliest months, even perhaps a year or two, over the ways in which it had been done. And the real fact was the administration and even the new Board of Regents, the combined Board of Regents, where again the WSU members were unacquainted or unused to as much faculty input as Madison was, simply didn't recognize problems that we thought were of considerable consequence. There was also a question of just exactly how the regents themselves operated in it. And they wanted regents on committees. And we felt that as a general rule, regents on committees were a mistake because it was the regents that would have the final selection process in whatever list we proposed to them. Mm-hmm. But although there was this friction, the general outcome was fairly satisfactory to Madison, but it did take a couple of years to achieve that.
Well, who was the friction was between the Madison faculty and the Central Administration. And what about the WSU faculty? Did they?
Well, we tried to encourage the WSU faculty to join us in this, and they did, in a sense, eventually join us, but it was clearly the Madison faculty and the UW system that led the criticism here and pushed for a change in practice. This was, since just as the WSU faculty weren't used to doing this thing, and the WSU regents weren't used to it, so they weren't the ones that were initiating as much of the criticism as we were doing.
And who made the appointment of Don Percy?
President Weaver.
Who had been a Madison president, or at least UW system president.
Yes, he had been a UW system president, but only for a very short period of time, and without having gotten back to the understanding of the Madison campus in the sense that perhaps at one time he may have had.
That was quite a slip, wasn't it?
we thought it was very significant, and we really had one or two very major confrontations with Mr. Weaver. And as I said, I don't think it didn't affect any specific appointment that was in preparation or was going through to the regents or that the regents took action on. It did affect, however, the rules that were eventually hammered out in terms of search and screen for the system, so that today's regulations or rules, and in fact those that were developed by 73, I believe, did incorporate the kinds of means that we had always seen as a traditional way for Madison to gain a new administrator, in which the faculty input was substantial. The faculty input really means that the faculty committee, with some administrators on it, is able to look over possible candidates within the system and across the country, and to screen out those candidates that the committee believes would not make satisfactory administrators or would not satisfactorily fill the deanship or the chancellor or the top positions in the system, the vice president for academic affairs, the president, etc. And in those cases, to insist on having a review by the faculty and having only those candidates on the list that meet the standards that the faculty believes are critical here. I should add, there was also in this some power playing between people representing the UW system and those representing the WSU system. Some power playing as to who out of the administration, out of the set of administrators of the UW system and the WSU system, would have the positions. Mm-hmm. And so part of this was a power play between those two groups of people. And in fact, Mr. Weaver had insisted upon a search and screen procedure when it involved somebody from WSU and had not insisted on it when it involved somebody from the UW system. And so we were really in the playing something here in the midst of a power play where we were not directly involved.
Yes, that's curious. You mean what you wanted, which was search and screen. He did enforce for the WSU people who weren't particularly concerned about it.
Yes, but didn't enforce it where there were UW people, so that the promotion of Mr. Percy was done unilaterally by Mr. Weaver, whereas some of the other things he had tried to insist upon a search and screen procedure.
But why?
Because I think he was trying to get as many UW system people into positions as he could do. And while we might have approved of some of the outcomes, we felt that there were bad precedents being set, and that regardless of the outcomes, it was critical that we make certain that the procedures be such that we could live with them in the future.
And was it Don Percy specifically that you objected to, or just the...
Well, it was the Don Percy appointment that really alerted us to the problems here.
Well, I mean, he as a person, would you have chosen somebody else if you'd had the say in the matter?
The fact is we were very careful, and I think rightly, of not saying that we approved or disapproved of Don Percy.
No, but I mean, I'm asking you.
I don't really have a distinct comment, because our problem was procedure and not the individual, and it was important to us on it. Now, some of us may not have been particular enthusiasts for Mr. Percy, but that was really beside the point. The point was the procedure.
Yeah, okay, but it is interesting. I think that Fred Harrington brought in Don Percy and Don Smith and Charles Amon.
No, Don Smith came in. No, Harrington did not bring in Don Smith. Don Smith was brought in by Weaver. He had known him from Minnesota. And actually, Don Smith came in later, and he did come in under what we would consider a standard search and screen procedure.
I see. you know, they're both being dons and both being vice presidents, one-tenth, or
yes.
at least I have to equate them, but
yeah.
I suppose they're not at all equatable, really.
Yes, I'm finding difficulty with certainty. I think Don Smith came in originally as academic vice president, and Don Percy had been put into the executive vice president. I think that was the title he had. He was, in fact, in charge of all of the budget and financial affairs of the university, which inevitably linked up with academic concerns.
Mm. Well, what did you know him? You
Don
must have had a lot of dealings with him.
Oh, I knew Don Percy, and of course I knew Don Smith, yes.
Well, what were they like as administrators, and how did you rate them as what they did for the UW or against it?
Well, Don Smith came, actually Don Smith had gotten his PhD from Wisconsin, and President Weaver had known him for many years, because Smith, I believe, got his PhD under President Weaver's father. When he was here, I think it was under Andrew Weaver. And then he had had most of his career at the University of Minnesota. And President Weaver had begun his academic career at the University of Minnesota, and for a variety of reasons had known Don Smith quite well. The general opinion of Don Smith, I believe, would be that his heart was always in the right place, that he understood what a good university was, and that he was sympathetic to Madison concerns, but like so many people in central administration, we weren't always sure that he took his strong steps to take care of Madison as we wanted. Now that's no doubt a very biased position, and one would need somebody more outside it than I am, or than most Madison faculty people probably are. As you know, Don Smith is now on the Madison faculty, and there was no question of his competence. There was no, I know, for example, that I wrote to a close friend of mine on the Minnesota faculty and asked him about Don Smith, just for my own information, and you couldn't have gotten a stronger endorsement of him than I had from this faculty friend in Minnesota. Mm-hmm. So Don Smith, although he was definitely somebody President Weaver wanted, and sometimes one is always suspicious of whomever you know that an administrator wants very badly. But the fact is, there was nothing in Don Smith's career that faculty members could have objected to. He had all the background. He had the kinds of distinctions. He had the kind of knowledge. He had been vice president in Minnesota for a period.
Mm-hmm.
So he had both the faculty academic training, experience, and administrative experience that were important. He came here and wanted to come here, probably because of some personal reasons that made a transfer from Minnesota desirable in his own terms, but they were entirely personal reasons that had nothing to do with the quality. Now, there was one other problem with Don Smith, in the fact that he didn't come to take over that position until many appointments had been made, appointments that probably Don Percy had a good deal of input in making, but whoever made them, they were the junior positions. So when Don Smith came, he really had a staff in place, and that's not necessarily the best way in which to take over and really have control in an operation.
Yeah, I can imagine that, and he couldn't do much about it.
Well, he didn't do much about it. I don't recall all of it. It seems to me that at the time the appointment was proposed and made, he was in the Far East on some kind of an activity, whether for AID or whom he was working with in Asia, I have forgotten. And he didn't come for some months, so that, in fact, much of the staffing was done prior to his arrival.
Do you have any names in mind? of people like, is it Wally Lemon, or is that...
No, Wally Lemon was in a different... No, I can't think now who the people were. They were junior staff people, mm-hmm. but I have forgotten. Okay. I just know it was true. When you looked at the listing payrolls, you would find that when Don Smith arrived, there weren't many additions or changes that could have been related specifically mm-hmm. to Don Smith.
And then, so what about Don Percy then?
Well, Don Percy is an interesting person in many ways. He is very bright. He had had substantial administrative experience. I always insisted he had a kind of love-hate relation as far as the faculty were concerned. He was contemptuous in some respects. The faculty didn't understand administration, didn't know how to do things that were necessary to be done in a university. On the other hand, I think that he was always a bit uneasy because he didn't have the academic qualifications that faculty members had. So that you got a certain type of tension. And I've used this term love-hate in talking about him to a number of people, and I think most of the people I've missaid it to have agreed with me that he found it very difficult sometimes not to be a little extreme or to do things because he just, in ways that tended to be very irritating to faculty members. And his competence there was simply no question of. He had come here initially from the Department of Defense. I believe he'd been one of McNamara's so-called whiz kids, at least in a junior sense he had been. And he came here initially to work with the mathematics defense contract. Yeah. And then he had worked with Ed Young in the L&S Dean's office. And then he had gone up into central administration. I believe Bob Clodius was the one that found invaluable, or made the appointment. There were always arguments that he was never very loyal to anybody, the people he worked with, that he sometimes undercut them if he saw the opportunity. I would certainly have to insist that I think he's bright and that he had real administrative skills.
I've heard it said, and I guess this probably common knowledge, that he and Don Smith ran the administration, in effect. That is, that Weaver really wasn't...
I think most people felt that Weaver enjoyed the ceremonial status side of the presidency much more than he enjoyed any of the give and take and necessity for administration. And he got very upset, as he got upset with the university committee and the committee that represented the faculty UW system. He got very upset when we questioned his method of doing certain things.
Really?
This was not appropriate. We weren't supposed to do that. And he went so far as one time when we were into this crisis on the search and screen to threaten to resign. And
Was that a threat? I mean, would you have minded?
Well, this was early, and we did. I'm not sure all of us would have minded, but we weren't exactly prepared to be the cause célèbre in this situation. Mm. Anyway, I don't really think he meant it. I think he was just trying to, he was just very irritated with us for taking the kinds of positions of criticism that we took. He's by no means the only president of universities or other major institutions who find the ceremonial and status things more satisfying than having to get down and really make hard decisions on a variety of issues. Because inevitably, if you make hard decisions, and I suppose in a sense inevitably, even if you try not to have to make them, there are going to be people who don't agree with you. And people who object fairly strenuously to what you, and be very critical. And so it was in that sense that he found the presidency, I think, distasteful. In the long run, he didn't find it distasteful as long as he had things relatively smoothly. But, and it was one of the things, of course, that I'm sure accounted for the fact that the regents, in effect, did not make any real attempt to give him an extension after he reached 62, which had become the retirement age for major administrators.
Mm.
But the regents themselves were divided. And there was, of course, another thing that was difficult in this. The Board of Regents had made the appointment of Mr. Weaver after they had, in effect, fired Harrington. They made the appointment of Mr. Weaver just before the election results, so that even though it was probable that Mr. Lucy was going to win the governorship, and even though that meant in all probability that you were going to have a different, you weren't going to have as an absolutely Republican dominated Board of Regents, and it might could mean several other things, despite all of that, the Regents in fact made the appointment within days before the election in 1970, and the resulting change in political structure in the state government at that point. And that put the thing in a bad light. So Mr. Weaver came here, came almost immediately, and
this must have had an effect on how the whole thing went.
Well, it did, although I don't know exactly what changes would have made. I don't think it had any it had nothing to do with merger. And of course, part of the, when I was talking about some of the power struggles there, when merger occurred in the fall of 71, the question, of course, was who was going to be president. And there really did become an understanding, partly because of Mr. McPhee's age and so on, that it would be Mr. Weaver. And then there were apparently some deals made as to who would be the different vice presidents and so forth, all related to that merging of the two system top administrations.
Do you think Lucy had something to do with Don Percy's appointment?
No, I have no reason to believe that.
I read an extraordinary quote of Weaver when he's speaking to Weaver and to Lucy in the Cap Times. Did he really talk like that? I mean, just
I don't know what
awful
quote
language, vulgar language.
I don't recall that Weaver used vulgar language under. I don't recall any instance in which he did. That's not my memory of it. I don't say that there might not have been some occasions where he was with a group of men or something that he might not have. I don't know. I just never heard it. It was not something
he was berating Lucy and
well, there was no question there was no love lost between Lucy and Weaver. And part of that was not Weaver's fault, but he certainly contributed to it. And of course they had agreed that there would not, Weaver didn't come here on the assumption there was going to be a merger of the two systems. That was certainly a bolt out of the blue as far as Weaver was concerned. But I think his presidency in Missouri had not been terribly successful, at least in retrospect, that seems to have been clear. So that the fact that his presidency here had a good many rough spots probably should have been anticipated.
It must be an exceedingly mild way of putting it, but
he was a very good photographer, and there were some of us who thought that's what he should have stayed with. he really was an excellent photographer. I don't know if you ever saw any things, but he did magnificent, especially he did a lot of things of animals and I mean, really the wild animals, and he just really had, he had different shows around. He really was a fine photographer.
Well, good.
And I guess he was a good geographer, a scholar. He was a, that's what he was trained in. I guess as a geography scholar, he was a good scholar. But I think he probably got beyond the administrative heights that would have been most satisfactory for his abilities.
Well, the other issue relating to administration, I think, was the question the committee raised as to how many tenure appointments you were going to have to take on from central administration or from the UW system. Chuck Ingman was the member.
Vaguely. This goes back and relates to the whole issue of search and screen. There is no question that some of Mr. Harrington's appointments had not been handled in a search and screen fashion. I think Mr. Engman was certainly one of these. And then it appeared that...
Excuse me, was that a question then, or did that only get to be an issue as it happened more and more?
The question of search and screen.
When Harrington, for instance, hired Engman, was there a fuss?
I don't believe so. I think that he was in a sufficiently low... I should correct myself. Mr. Engman and two or three or more of the people in Harrington's office, some of whom remained there and some of whom didn't, had come into the president's office under an internship arrangement. And presumably they were interns from other university administrations around the country, and presumably in many of these instances they were expected to return to the administration from which they came. The faculty, therefore, in a search and screen capacity, had no reason to raise issues about these individuals because of the type of thing that they involved. Mr. Harrington, however, hired several of these, and Mr. Engman was one of them. And so in that sense, I suppose Mr. Engman can be used as a kind of example of the problem that then arose, to the extent that the new administration didn't want them. There was some assumption, although not much legal base for it, that the Madison campus had a responsibility for these people. And the faculty committee, of course, felt that this was a difficult one because they had not had faculty status, they were not faculty members, they had not been screened with the possibility or probability that they might eventually have tenure on the Madison faculty. So as I recall it, each of these cases was discussed at some length and in a sense cleared as exceptions where they were cleared, and I guess most of them were, cleared as exceptions to the norm because of this background.
And why did you clear them?
Where an individual, and in Mr. England's case this was true, were an individual in effect found a department or unit of the university that itself was willing to take them on, or wanted, in some cases, really wanted to take them on, we then operated to clear them for that position. I think that's as precise as I can be. One never has all black and white. There are always gray instances, and I guess this is one of those gray situations where if a department was willing to take on somebody of this kind, then we agreed to clear them. there weren't enough people involved that this was going to infect the whole Madison faculty or Madison campus. As I recall, there were only about three instances, I've forgotten, and at least one of those went somewhere else, and one went into a position which may have faculty rank, I'm not sure, but it's within the chancellor's office and therefore didn't constitute an issue. Well, there was another one. But each of these sort of got solved in some fashion. Mm-hmm. I can think of four cases, and as I say, one left, two were absorbed into departments, including Mr. Engelman, and one was assigned within the chancellor's office. Mm-hmm. See, it would have been Bob Taylor and, who is it in the chancellor's office? Who's in the PR field there?
It's not Art Hovey's.
Art Hovey, yeah. I don't know anything else to add particularly to that unless you've got a direct question.
No, I guess not.
Well, so we pick up that problem of the salaries.
All right, the wage freeze business.
Yeah, so that was in the summer of 1972.
Now that's the background. What that is quite clear in the document. So
all
it
right.
would be interesting for you to talk
this
about.
This was a case where Mr. Nixon was president, and there was an attempt to control inflation by wage and price freezes. And the way in which the wage freeze operated, it became a question of what the salaries at an institution were as of August 1st, I believe. In the case of Wisconsin, the regents had not taken action to clear any salaries for the university as of July 1st. Hence, although the intent and the assumption, which had of course occurred in many other instances, to make salary increases retroactive, we're now faced with the issue of our standing vis-a-vis the national order from the president's wage freeze council, which I believe was headed by Mr. Dunlop, an economist from Harvard. In any event, we protested and we tried to get some exceptions out of Washington. We cleared with other universities to see what they were doing. We found, as a general rule, we were pretty much alone in being an institution in which the regents had not taken action as early as we believed they could have, and certainly if they had taken action, would have avoided the whole contretemps.
Excuse me, we as the university committee.
Yes, we as the university committee. We worked with the chancellor on this. We worked through anyone that we could think of that might have some in that would be valuable to us. As I recall, nothing we did any good, and the increases were delayed for something like 3 months, weren't
mm-hmm.
they?
Mm-hmm.
I have forgotten now the exact amount. I think we did succeed in getting the regents to take a more concerned and more efficient approach to approving salary increases, so that this type of thing was less likely to happen in the future. Of course, there are two difficulties here. One is that the state legislature may not act on the budget in time for clearance for the July 1st payrolls. Given the usual way in which the state legislature acts on the budget, this has not typically been a problem, and it was not in previous years or in succeeding years. But it is a difficulty with which the regions have to deal, because they cannot technically clear salary increases until they know the amount of the budget. Now, there have been some means developed for faster clearance, even a special meeting of the Board of Regents, since most of the salary increases are reviewed by the Board of Regents as pro forma. They pay almost no attention to salary increases except for administrative positions throughout the system, for the top administrative positions, and for faculty increases that are above certain levels. Either the amount of the increase or the faculty salary is above certain level. Even in these cases, which they presumably review a little more than they do the rest of the faculty salary increases, even in these cases, it's almost entirely pro forma. There was a time, decades ago, when the regents went over everyone, and it was assumed or presumed, or there was actual evidence that on occasion individual faculty regents might raise issues about salaries of particular faculty members. So far as I ever saw during the period that I was aware of what was going on, there was never any of this. It was not a concern for individual faculty members, but technically they had the review power, and they had to exercise that in order to make the salaries legal. There have been simply a number of ways in which they've tried to hurry up their procedure and to get tentative approval pending certain decisions of the state legislature, so that the likelihood of the problem we face is a great deal less. I don't say every possible one is taken care of, but the likelihood is less today than it was then.
Yeah. But you didn't feel that the administration was pursuing the whole thing vigorously enough at the time.
Well, we certainly didn't think the central administration was pursuing it vigorously.
Well, even the chancellor.
And well, I'm a little vague about it. My memory is, and this is one of those times when Mr. Young may not have been there the whole time, and it also was probably one of those times when Mr. Young actually was doing things behind the scenes and not totally conferring with us on it, even. Which frequently he did do. I should say he frequently did both. He often worked behind the scenes. This was very standard procedure. He did know Mr. Dunlop. He knew he and Bob Fleming at Michigan were close friends, and I think afterwards we were conscious that he had been in touch and had been working with both of them.
Had you also independently called Fleming?
Yes, I think we did. I honestly can't recall, but I think we did.
Yeah.
I think we got in touch with Fleming, and we tried to do some other things. And we were very concerned that there wasn't as much effort being made as we thought could have been. But it's also possible that everything was done that was possible, that the order had gone out, it had not been anticipated, and the regents had not acted, and this confused, and the type of action the regents had taken was such that it had confused the issue to the point that the legal standing was really open to substantial question.
Mm. Well, I took down the quote: the chancellor was urged to pursue with vigor the recovery of faculty salaries lost because of wage price freeze, you wanted the administration to, it was the question of whether it would get new state funds to pay the increases or reallocate them, and you told the chancellor this. So it seems as if the committee was watchdogging and really pushing at the chancellor.
I don't remember how much we were we were uneasy that the chancellor wasn't doing as much as we thought he ought to. It's conceivable that we were partly watchdogging, both to be sure that he did and to be sure that it was clear how we stood on the issue so that he could use what we were saying and doing in resolutions as part of the background for his activities. And I think the second part of that is about as important or maybe more important than the first. But I admit that my memory on the details of this is a bit unclear, and I just thought, I don't come away today with a feeling that we felt Ed Young wasn't looking after our interests. Mm. He did do it sometimes in a somewhat unconventional way, and therefore we sometimes felt, as I say, both to push him and to give him ammunition that we made decisions and made resolutions.
Did you feel, lucky you were a chairman when Young was dean, did you feel that he was different as a chancellor than he was as dean, that he changed his way of working?
No, I didn't see much difference in the way he worked as dean or as chancellor. Obviously his position was different. Ed Young had his own ways of operating as an administrator, and they are frequently not the ways of many other administrators, though it was often a successful one. There is a standing joke that if anything, any decision could be let alone, and solve itself, that's what he liked to do. He did work on issues, and he certainly worked for Madison's interest vis-a-vis central administration, and it was quite clear that he and Mr. Weaver were on rather tense terms, so that he was looking, there was no question he was looking after our interests. But he has a particular personality, he has a particular way of doing things that is not the executive style of making decisions and crossing that off and going to the next one and crossing that off, which many people see as the ideal administrator. He didn't do it that way. He tended to make decisions that had to be made, but if they could be put off, he always felt that many of them didn't have to be made, and you simply had a smoother operation if you didn't have to make certain kinds of decisions. And this was the way he operated. And he often talked to people informally. Calling people at night was common practice. In fact, I know there were times when he probably made a dozen or more calls in the evening to individual faculty members, to university committee members, to legislators, and perhaps to the governor, and tried to talk with them and get their opinions and smooth things out that way, rather than setting forth an absolute rule or regulation or making an absolute decision that would get great public prominence. This was his style to do it indirectly more than to do it on some very formalized basis.
Well, you make a study of administration. How would you rate him as, say, against Irv Shane or earlier presidents or chancellors as?
Well, he and Irv Shane, of course, worked together, and in many ways they were a very good combination when Ed was president and Shane was vice president. As long as they managed to work together, and they did for quite a few years there, I think it was an excellent combination, because Irv is a much more organized, much more structured type of person who likes to make decisions and clear them off his desk. And he probably is not as good at the less formal fashion of dealing with problems, the less formal fashion. His political instincts probably aren't as strong as Ed's. Ed, after all, had been more or less in politics on periphery for a long, long time. Even his work as a labor economist led in many ways into the kinds of things where your political skills are very critical. Irv, on the other hand, was a chemist, had been chairman of the chemistry department, and in fact that was, I know, one of the reasons that Ed Young chose him to be vice chancellor. He admired the way he had run the chemistry department, thought very highly of him in that role, and therefore felt he'd be a very good administrator.
Was there a search screen for Shane?
Yes.
As vice chancellor?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so that they complemented each other. They were very different styles, but they complemented each other. Now, to an extent, that's true of Irv and Bri Curl. Bri is, although his style is different than Ed's, he's got many of the political skills that Ed had and much of the political knowledge. And so that, again, the combination is such that you get a certain complementarity. Mm-hmm. And of course, Irv Shane was named as chancellor by Ed when he was president, so that the relationship there was such that this was a perfectly feasible appointment from Ed's point of view.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Yes, I know that. And I guess he... I think had some triumphs of decision, or Shane did, as in regard to the medical school. And I should have asked you. You dealt with Feinsinger, Nathan Feinsinger, on the wage price thing. Did you? That was seems you have you yourself.
I guess, yeah, I'd forgotten that. Well, you see, Nate Feinsinger, of course, had dealt with wage price controls, I believe, in World War II, and knew. And certainly, again, he knew Dunlop. He knew many of the people who were involved. So I guess we went to Nate. Probably
you went to him, or he do you remember?
I think
that?
We went to Nate. And again, this could well have been Ed Young's suggestion. Mm-hmm. Ed had a very strong feeling of liking for Nate, respect for Nate, a feeling that Nate understood some of the issues in this kind of situation. Nate was a labor law lawyer in large part, and so again there was a complementarity of knowledge between Ed and Nate, and so that's no doubt why we went to talk to him or had him come to see us. I've forgotten.
Did he achieve anything, do you know, or did it? You don't know. Okay.
I simply don't recall that. Nate was usually better at giving advice than following through, I would say.
Oh.
That might not have been true in earlier years, but it was by the time we knew him.
He already had Parkinson's disease.
Oh, yes. Very substantially.
Okay. I do want to know, your view of Borcher's appointment, if you know anything about him. This is just because Serena Pondrum talked about him, and I thought it'd be interesting to know whether you had any...
He was
vice chancellor for a while. He replaced Irv Shane when he went to Washington.
Oh, I'd really forgotten that, but now that you say I knew Borcher slightly.
No, he was working under Irv Shane, I think. Anyway, he was...
Well, all I can say is that Borchers had worked with us. Of course, he was here on the faculty, and he had worked with us on a number of faculty or university committees, subcommittees, and so forth that we had appointed. And my memory is that he normally did the contributed what one would expect from a substantial member of the faculty. It seems to me he was an associate dean of the graduate school at that point.
Yes, that's right, he was.
Yes.
In charge of the hard sciences.
Yes, but we sometimes asked him to work with us on given policies. And while I didn't know Bob Borchers well, my impression is almost totally positive. There may be something that I'm not thinking about, but my general impression is almost totally positive that he was successful as associate dean, that he was helpful to us on problems that we brought up, that he joined us occasionally on some of the faculty, inter-university faculty meeting, faculty committee meetings that we had, and was valuable there.
Mm. I meant to ask you about the dinners, the dinner parties you had.
Well, there was a, there was no, I didn't even know that came out in the minutes. Well,
yes, it does.
All right. During the last, certainly the last 2 years that I was on the university committee, and perhaps even the first year, we felt that it was important as a university committee to get in touch with certain people. That included all members of the Board of Regents. It included certain leading legislators. Those are the two groups that I think of particularly. And we decided to do that by having small suppers. We didn't invite them all at one time in any occasion. Having small suppers or occasionally having a cocktail party. And we did it in my house. The other members of the university committee thought and obviously found that very satisfactory because there was nobody else around. I was the only one that would be there in the house, and there was no question then of anybody running in and out, anything unrelated happening. And so we had these affairs, and I forgot now just how many we had, but we had quite a number over time. I know when I was talking about the legislators, we had both the Madison delegation as a whole, and then we had a certain other leaders from the legislature apart from the Madison delegation, as I recall. And I think we had about three times, we divided the Board of Regents into three or four groups. And
That's what I couldn't figure out. You'd have three.
Yeah, we just had three or four people. We didn't have the whole Board of Regents.
At once, but you eventually had them all. Is that right?
We eventually tried to have that. Oh, and then we also did that with the top central administration. I recall we had Mr. Smith and Mr. Weaver, I know, and I've forgotten just who
did
else.
Did you do this with wives? I mean, this was just strictly business.
It was simply business, and it was simply the university committee members. And since I was a member of the university committee, there was nobody else there but the university committee members and these officials whom we invited.
Yeah.
And some of the time we talked very real business and strategy and tactics and so forth and so on. Sometimes we did it on a much more social basis. Partly this probably differed in terms of whether we felt we were going to be able to work with these people closely or not. But I felt, and I think other members of the university committee felt, that this was well worth doing. That we too often deal with people at such an arm's length basis. I mean, university does, and the university faculty, as represented by the university committee, deal with them at such arm's length basis that we never get into as close a relationship as, and the chit-chat kind of thing that's possible in this situation. So we by no means had formal agendas. Mm-hmm. We didn't insist on it being business. It varied. Sometimes it would turn into a kind of business thing after, well, it was a supper party. After supper, it might turn into a kind of business thing as we talked strategy and tactics. But other times it didn't. It just